Hello?
Hello?
Hello? You
pod
to win the game. That's the great thing about sports.
You pod to win the game.
All right, welcome into You Pod to Win the Game. I am Charles Robinson, here today with Charles McDonald, C-Mac, and Jory Epstein. I am so glad to finally be back on the show. I have been gone so long and had nothing to do with like having that cough and feeling like crap all that time. It was internet issues, deadline issues, every other issue. But I come back and I feel pretty good. I feel healthy. I'm liking this. How you guys doing?
No more cough?
Yeah, no, it's gone. It's gone. Now Dawn has it. She's had it
caring.
Yeah, she's had it for about a week. And I'm like, you got about a month ahead, maybe a month and a half. So settle in. It's going to be a long one.
Oh, no, goodness.
But I feel great.
It feels like a long time has passed since we were on this podcast. So excited to be back at full capacity, full employment, as my family likes to say. So it's nice to have you. And I'm glad that your Wi-Fi is cooperating.
Yeah. Wi-Fi. I've got everything up and running. This is just in time. There are things happening in the league that we have to talk about. I'm excited. There's some last bits of news. We're going to see full squad camps are wrapping up. We've got Dalvin Cook gets released by the Minnesota Vikings. So we're going to get into all that. We're going to get into a piece that I actually wrote that went up today about the PGA LIV merger and the idea of like sovereign money making its way into American sports leagues and whether or not that could ever penetrate the NFL. The NFL has rules as it stands that do not allow foreign investment into the league. So we can get into all that. But first and foremost, I want to talk to you guys about Dalvin Cook. It's interesting because I went on Tennessee radio this morning and I get questions asked about like Derrick Henry and obviously the Saquon Barkley situation with the New York Giants. It looks like the Giants are trying to basically look at Saquon, at least right now, as a year-to-year player. Feels like Derrick Henry when he was sort of pocket listed for trade with the league. He looked like a year-to-year player when you talk to franchises about why would you acquire Derrick Henry where you acquire him because you're in a window. You're just going to try and pay him year-to-year because he's in his late 20s and he's got a lot of wear and tear. Dalvin Cook, similar type of player, not quite as close to 30 as some of the other players we've talked about, but a lot of wear and tear there. Gets cut loose by the Vikings and now is out there on the table for a potential contender. I'm just curious, you know, do either of you, the Dolphins have been the team that has been naturally connected to him? There's needs elsewhere with other Super Bowl teams. If you were to sort of, I don't know, I guess put odds on it, you know, what team do you feel like really has the inside track on him? Right?
I mean, we've seen the Dolphins, right? But I'm not sure how much sense that makes. Well, they just drafted Devin Achane in the third round. And before that, like they already had a pretty crowded running back room with guys like Mostert and Jeff Wilson, who figured to have a role in this team this year. I thought that, you know, it kind of made sense at first, just like thinking about it without digging into it, because at least from there, it seems like he wants to play for the Dolphins. But it would make an unnecessarily crowded back room and backfield. And I just kind of question like if that is the route that they want to go right now. To me, it's kind of hard to like peg a landing spot for him because it all depends on like what he wants to be or what he's willing to be, I guess, at this point in his career. Because I know that, you know, he still had over 1,000 yards last year. But I think when you actually start examining how those 1,000 yards came to be, it wasn't really all that efficient. I think you could start to see signs of the wear and tear starting to get to him a little bit. But yeah, I've thought about this a lot and I've struggled to find a landing spot, but maybe like, do the Bills make sense? It's like
a three-headed. No, don't say it.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. I don't know. I don't know anything. I don't know anything anymore. Jory, why don't you take it from here?
Yes. No, I agree in terms when you look at his efficiency, he had a career low 4.4 yards per attempt in 2022. I think what's interesting is that when you look at Ezekiel Elliott going on 3 months unsigned, I think it's relevant to where Dalvin Cook would land, which is that teams want to cut big running back contracts, not add them. We see that with the Saquon Barkley debate as well. And so to me, this is not going to be about who's going to pay him the most, because I don't think he's going to get the money that he wants. Now, God bless him if he does. I don't root against players getting their money. I just don't think that the league is currently trending in that direction, especially when you have three guys playing on franchise tags at that position right now. The reason I like a team like the Bills is, first of all, their top running back on their depth chart right now is James Cook. Do you guys know much about James Cook?
I don't know.
But my point is that I think that...
Oh, I thought that was a joke about him being his brother.
Wait, is that?
Yeah, oh my Dalvin God. And James are brothers.
Wow. She found that out right in the middle. Okay. As a research team, someone in research is getting fired.
It's literally on my screen right now. Brother Dalvin Cook. Wait, guys, this is actually really funny because I always say, like, I have very little institutional knowledge, but I'm eager to learn. And this is a prime example.
Don't cut any of this out, by the way.
Just don't clip it for social. Anyway, we're definitely going to get tweets about this. Anyway, all that to say, he's not very proven. It would be really cute if the brothers played together. But I think the point is that I don't think Dalvin is going to get the money he wants. And if you don't get the money you want an opportunity where you're going to get the carries and where you have a chance to win. Right. And so that's why I think a team like the Bills make the most sense.
So here's the thing with him. So I made a couple.
Maybe his brother's there.
Yeah. Well, it would help if you know, it's an easier tandem to work when you're working with your brother, I would suppose. So when I talked to a couple teams about Dalvin, and I haven't done the film work, maybe Charles or Jory, you have, but what I was told was you can see there's probably some reticence to consider him this three down back who's going to be able to come in, block when you need him to block, run inside when you need him to run inside effectively and consistently, still give you the speed to beat people, you know, to the edge and break the big plays. Catch the ball in the backfield and also work in the slot, which is what teams, when teams want to pay more than $10 million for a running back now, that's what they're looking at. You have to be able to break out in the slot consistently. You have to be able to block so we don't have to take you off the field. You have to give us big plays. You have to have speed. And oh, by the way, you can't be finesse. You got to be able to run inside. If you can't run inside consistently when we need tough yards, that's going to be a problem. And that was the criticism of Dalvin, some of the tough yardage. Relative to the price tag, then maybe you're looking at him saying, sure, we can add him, but it sounds like he wants 10 million plus. He wants to be around that 10 million mark. Yeah. And there's not a lot of takers out there for any running back really at that price point at this stage, particularly someone with the mileage of Dalvin. And then also teams will continue to focus on, hey, some of the off-field stuff, whatever happened to that? Like, is he a completely clean player when it comes to on-field versus off-field evaluation? And then his health. And I would say his health probably takes number one priority for teams. This is the NFL. And they look at his health and his track record, and he plays games, you know, banged up. He seems to get, you know, suffer different types of injuries. And again, he's advanced in his career. It feels like a bad bet for a number of teams. But again, I think it comes down to him making it about money versus a team looking at him and saying, this is it. This is the piece that gets us over the top. But as you both said, the running back market, it sucks. Like Derrick Henry was out there for anyone. You want to come get Derrick Henry? Great. Come get Derrick Henry. Never happened. There was no interest out there. You know, Jonathan Taylor's right now worried about, what is my contract situation going to look like when I got to sign a long-term contract? He's not an old guy. He's got wear and tear. He's had some injuries, but he's a dominant running back who still is in his prime. Saquon Barkley, I get it. There's a long track record, you know, in terms of the health there, where you would be worried if you're the New York Giants. But it doesn't even really feel like the Giants are even close to considering paying him long-term. I could be wrong. He probably just signed his deal, right, as I said that. I don't know, man. It's a bad spot to be in. And this, is, to me, is the continuation of every running back conversation we've ever had. And I believe more than ever now, running backs for teams are going to be looked at as five-year to six-year commodities. Unless you're a truly special player, you're a 5 to 6 year player, you know, for whatever particular team when you come in at the running back position.
Saquon made an interesting point this week that I'm curious what y'all think about, which is that, yes, we know that Miles Sanders made the most in free agency of any running back this year, and it was not a particularly lucrative contract, about $6.25 million per year, the average per year, and the guarantees were like half of what we were seeing a few years ago with a guy like Nick Chubb. But he was saying Tony Pollard, Josh Jacobs, Saquon Barkley, all on the tag right now. So is it that the market is what Miles Sanders got, or is it that these guys are eventually going to get maybe not back to like the 15, 16 million, but at least back to 11 or 12 versus what Sanders did? It's just that they're all tagged at the same time.
That's the crazy thing, is that as fewer and fewer hit these massive big deals, the tag's going to get cheaper because of how the tag works. The tag being an average of what, the top five?
10.1, yeah.
Yeah. So it's, as those big deals shrink, the tag gets cheaper, which means what? The tag becomes more attractive. Don't sign a long-term deal. The tag's getting better and better every single year. Let's just keep tagging these guys as long as we can. And then if we burn through two tags, they actually show up to play on two tags, then you just release them. You go, okay, you're fine. We're going to let you go to free agency. You don't release them. You let them go to free agency. But yeah, I mean, it does suck. Charles, you were saying, I mean, this sucks. It's a bad situation for running backs. But I mean, it's just, this is the position that's getting screwed right now.
When you look at, when you just look around the league for like landing spots for Dalvin, I know it, you know, it's June and coming off the offseason, most teams, you feel good about where you're at coming to the year. But like, what team is like in need of a running back right now when you just start looking across the league?
But let's not think of, okay, how about we approach it like this? Instead of saying what team is in need, where could he go? And I mean, just have maximum damage. Where could he go and be a player who could be an all-pro level running back? I mean, like, I'm sorry, I can't not look at Kansas City and be like, I don't know, you put Dalvin Cook in Kansas City. Seems like it's going to be a pretty good situation for him, or really any dominant running back. And it's not like they don't have some need. I get it. Pacheco, I like what they have there. I'm not saying that, you know, they're dying for a running back, but I'm just saying, you take a guy who still could be a top echelon player, at least for another year, and you put him on Kansas City. I think that makes, I felt the same way about Odell. Put Odell in Kansas City. He's, you know, I'm looking at year-to-year players where they could go and really maximize themselves. I can't think of any place better than going and playing with Patrick Mahomes in terms of squeezing every last drop out at the end of your career.
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of surprised that the Vikings cut him at this point. You know, it's post-June 1, I should say. And you think that, especially a team like the Vikings, they would be trying to gear up for another run. And I feel like he wasn't so expensive that it wasn't worth keeping him. So I would start like, why did they feel like they needed to cut him now? And then that would have to play into what's next.
I think the Vikings are low-key rebuilding right now.
Yeah,
a little bit. They're stuck in the in-between phase. Because I think they realized that last year was fake, right?
Right.
There's a lot of green vibes.
Yeah, I forget what the stat exactly is, but there's something like their 11-0 record either in fourth quarter comebacks or in like late win games by 8 points or less was like unheard of historically. And so you just have to assume that some of this is going to revert to the mean. And I think that that is the case, because I don't think if you think you're contending this year that you're keeping that you're cutting Dalvin Cook now. As it relates to what it means for Dalvin, again, going back to the Zeke situation, I know they're not the same player, but they're in similar situations and he hasn't signed. I think that both these guys could end up waiting to sign like late training camp or even a few weeks into the season when their legs are fresh. Someone gets hurt inevitably. And oh, by the way, offensive linemen have like so little they can do in the preseason right now that it takes a few weeks for them to be able to like run block effectively anyway, in my opinion. And so I think that they're just like not in a rush. But I guess, why did the Vikings trade for TJ Hawkinson last year if they were rebuilding? Did they think like last year they still had enough juice that like they weren't quite there yet?
I think when you're in the middle of the run at that point, If you've caught lightning in a bottle, you try to maximize it if you can, right? And and let's be honest, I mean, tight end's not the richest acquisition. It's not the worst, you know. It's not going out and getting wide receiver one. So in the frame of sort of what was happening at that time, I thought it was doable. I didn't have a problem with it. And Hawkinson's still young enough that he should be able to factor in. When I say they're rebuilding, I mean. I truly think they're looking at Kirk Cousins right now and saying, yeah, the 2023 is like the ride. That's probably it. And we're going to have to figure out what we're going to do with quarterback elsewhere. Or, you know, after this, we're going to find out in training camp, you know, we'll figure out what maybe the plans are there. And then I think, you know, you go and you take Jordan Addison, right? You add him to the wide receiver spot, which, you know, he fits in perfectly, I think, with Justin Jefferson. And then, you know, running backs, I think the class next year could be, you know, solidly deep. B, it feels like teams can just find them now anyway. So even letting go of a running back in this situation, it's doable to replace that running back, I think, next year. To me, this all rotates around the quarterback. What are you going to do with the quarterback position? Are you trying to build it up to be impressive enough that you could go out and acquire like a veteran who we don't think is going to be available at this point, or somebody becomes available and they can walk in and really give you a good 2 or 3 year Super Bowl window? Or are you looking at Drake May, Caleb Williams, who knows who else could rise up out of the quarterback soup next year, and saying, okay, next year could be a pretty good quarterback draft. Let's figure out a way to offload whatever we can and figure out how to compile some assets then moving forward and potentially moving up in the draft. Or I don't know. I mean, maybe like we said, if they don't catch every green this year, if we're sitting here going, man, look at the Vikings went 7-10, probably wouldn't be shocked, right? I mean, they just didn't catch all the breaks in the year before. 7-10 at least puts you in shouting distance of maybe moving up to get a quarterback. It's just, is anyone at the top of the draft going to want to move out when these guys are considered generational next year? Let's talk about a couple of the interesting storylines in terms of players that are, you know, skipping mandatory mini camps, or you can just kind of feel that something's going on under the surface. You have Danielle Hunter, Chris Jones, both skipping camp as they seek contract extensions. Stephon Diggs, I hope one of you two is more wired into the Bills organization than I am, because I have not been able to figure out exactly what the heck's going on there. I don't know what this issue was. Obviously comes back into the fold. It's weird because it felt like the Bills sort of pushed the panic button for a second, for like a day, not even a day, a few hours. And then whatever needed to get smoothed over allegedly got smoothed over. Let's figure out if that's actually true. And then
they also canceled practice.
And then they canceled practice, right? So like, maybe
that's,
he wasn't
pretty normal in today's climate.
Yeah.
But it feels a little different when your star player comes up.
So bad that not only Stephon couldn't practice, nobody could. Is that better?
Yes.
Exactly. Sometimes it'd be like that, man. Sometimes it really does.
You know, and then Saquon Barkley, Jory, you went to Giants camp, and I definitely want to hear about Giants camp and the situation with Saquon. But you do definitely have a few guys where there seems to be some element of, I don't want to say, you know, discontent, a little bit of friction beneath the surface. Let's start with Hunter and Jones. Those feel like contract extensions that are going to get done. Am I wrong?
The Danielle Hunter one, I think that might be a little dicier than the Chris Jones one. Chris Jones, I feel like that he's a two
flyer. That's fair. I mean, Jones Danielle, is a cornerstone player for sure.
Yeah, and also with Danielle, like, it's not like this is the first time that he's been unhappy with this contract that he has signed with the Vikings. You know, I feel like this has been a recurring thing, like probably over the last, like, you know, a little mini story of the last 2 or 3 summers where, you know, you hear some rumbling of this. And I think that, you know, if you're going to be a team that is like, okay, we went 13-4, when we look at a close game record and we look at some of the comebacks we had, you know, the Colts game where they came down from like 30 points, the Bills game that was crazy at the end, it's unlikely to have a season like that going, you know, all the way in your favor again. And if you're trying to get, you know, just some assets back for what's been a pretty maxed out roster, I think Danielle Hunter might be the only player that you can realistically trade. Obviously, you can't trade Justin Jefferson, and it's not like they have a whole bunch of other guys. And I think that when you look at the contract and he wants more money, maybe that's not really in the cards for the Vikings. I think he kind of makes sense as a player that you can offload. But Chris Jones, that's a Chiefs lifer for sure.
And Danielle Hunter, you got a $13.1 million salary cap this year. Dead money, $5.6 million. I mean, I don't know. I think that so many of these things come down to how much does the team need you, and how much they need you depends on what they're actually capable of doing and also what they're building going forward. And so I don't know that he's got the leverage that maybe would be helpful to have. And I also think that how much does skipping mini camp actually do? I get that it sends a message, but I get that you can get fined, but I'm not sure that a team is like, you know what, because you weren't there on Tuesday, I want to pay you this money that I didn't want to pay you 3 days ago.
I don't think it's creating like face-to-face leverage with the team. I think it's creating the outside leverage. It's like when
the public, you know, pressure.
Yeah. When Zeke went through what Zeke did with the Cowboys, all that whole thing. I mean, Jory, you and I were probably talking to the same people all the way through that. And it was clear that their chief motivation was to make sure, like, here's Zeke working out. Here's what he looks like in Cabo. Like, here's, you know, and that was all about creating outside pressure to get something done. And frankly, if you're Danielle Hunter's agent, I'm sitting there going, okay, well, you're already talking about offloading Cousins, you know, or him not being around after 2023. That's a storyline right now. You just cut Dalvin Cook. Like, at some point, like, Vikings fans are going to be like, what the hell are we doing here? Like, we're just not just going to go ahead and surrender everything. Like, we're going to, you know,
quiet quitting.
I kind of get that avenue. I will agree, though, Chris Jones is the deal that, I mean, like, can't not do that deal, right? Like, you can't not.
And they already got rid of Frank Clark.
Yeah, this is one of those players.
It's not even no brainer. It's a no option type of thing.
No option. That does feel like that. He's just too dominant. And look, it's a tough pill to swallow, particularly considering you're now, you know, to the point where you're going to be Mahomes staring at the money, right? The money that Mahomes makes every year. And that's going to make it more, you know, difficult. But you also let go of Tyreek Hill, right? I mean, it's not like you've spent a ton of money to add to the wide receiver position. You didn't spend a ton of money to add to the running back position. So if Dalvin's not coming in, like, you better spend the money on, you know, making sure your dominant player on the other side of the ball is going to get done. So I think we can all agree that we feel like if Chris Jones doesn't get done, that would be a shock. Give me an idea, Diggs. Like, I'm lost on Diggs. I'm stunned because when it happened that day, I was like, man, I'll bet you I can figure this out by the end of the day. I can figure out what the hell's the problem here. Not even close. I still, right now, I have no clue what exactly happened that day, what the problem was. I figured it was contractual. I was told it was not football related. I still think when stuff like that happens, it's typically has something to do with money, but I don't, you know, we look at the Austin Eckler situation that gets resolved with incentives. You throw some incentives in his deal, it feels better. Okay, it's done. Just weird that this is going on with Diggs.
I was confused when it first started because he just got some money last year.
Yeah, it's a good deal.
So, it was a good deal. And, you know, a bunch of people brought it up that the deal was so good that he's literally stuck in Buffalo. There's no way that they could trade him really or cut him in a way that wouldn't like severely hamper their cap space for this year. So it really couldn't have been about that. I guess to me, I was thinking if it's not about money and I don't know if you and Sean McDermott put it, had a good conversation before things got so testy that Diggs had to leave. Is it something personal here? And once you're wading into that, I have no idea what to make of it because it doesn't really seem like there should be a whole lot of reasons for Stephon Diggs to be this unhappy unless it's like just like some personal intergoings that he's not happy about.
Doesn't seem to be, Jory, it doesn't seem to be an Allen thing, right? I mean, because Allen's come out and said, that's my guy. Like Allen, I feel like Josh Allen said everything, like thrown his weight behind Stephon Diggs in a way where you're like, it's definitely not the quarterback again, right? Because it was clearly the quarterback in Minnesota. It's not, I hope this is not the quarterback here, right?
Oh, no, I don't think it's the quarterback. And I think that Josh Allen is like, okay, guys, I'm going to be the adult in the room and remind you, like, we're working towards something here. Right. Let's not mess it up. I think that, I don't know if this was about a usage, if this was about scheme, if this was about some sort of philosophy on team building and what it means for this year. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of, and I'm not in the exact same way, but just like closest parallel, like DeAndre Hopkins, Bill O'Brien back in Houston in the day when it was like they didn't have this relationship. And how much do you need a relationship between your receiver and your head coach? And of course, now DeAndre is on his way to the Patriots to visit where Bill O'Brien is the offensive coordinator. I think that the generous reading would be that when Sean McDermott says he was very concerned that he's not at practice, it wasn't necessarily, I'm very concerned that he's skipping and it's a bad look. It's, I'm very concerned with the tension that we just built up in the conversation we had. He probably came to the podium like right after that conversation ensued. I don't know if one of them or both of them made a comment that they wished that they did not make, and it seemed to escalate from there. It is unusual, though, that you would see this level of tension in June.
Doesn't this underscore when you're close, when you're right on the doorstep of getting into a Super Bowl, you got to break through right then. You can't have this. We thought entering last season, the Bills are stacked. Mm-hmm. They're ready to take the step that, you know, this is it. This is the year Josh Allen ascends and everything comes together. And then, you know, as the season unfolds, we're like, God, man, they look like it. They caught the wind in their sails, you know, with the unfortunate injury to DeMar Hamlin, but then sort of how his recovery ensued. It just felt like a team of destiny. And then they fall short. And not only do they fall short, they roll back. They don't even make it into the AFC title game. In my mind, I'm like, this is proof positive. Now what we see with Diggs, you never know what's going to happen. Just because you're on the doorstep and you don't break through, you can't assume, well, we got next year. Like, now who knows? Like, this is not some shit they need when you're trying to pick it up after, you know, taking a step backward that was unexpected late in the season. And yet here we are. We're talking about, is Stephon Diggs happy, which is a pretty big deal in that organization, given what he is to Josh Allen.
They need Stephon, though. Like, the wide receiver depth, I don't think it's,
no,
it's what, it's not what they thought they were having going into last year. I think it's safe to say, you know, that Gabe Davis game against the Chiefs in the playoffs, where you have, you know, 200 yards and 4 touchdowns, that's just an anomaly game. That's not really who he is. So if Stephon like actually wasn't happy enough to not want to play there anymore, that would be a pretty, pretty serious problem for the Bills, because I think they're kind of lacking in, you know, just pure wide receiver talent outside of him. So we'll see what happens. They need him. And if this is about the, like, the last thing I have about this is, like, if it was about the quarterback, I would have to put that on Stephon, man. Like, your expectations might just be a little unrealistic here for what this is. Cause what, if you're going to go better, right. If you're going to go better than Josh Allen, like, there's maybe one guy in the league better, like, on just on a throw for throw basis. So let's everyone cool it. Let's have some fun, play some football, and hopefully they can get back to being normal. But that was real weird this week.
Yeah, the last question I'll ask is, do you think the fact that they're about to break for 5-6 weeks, like, will that cool it on its own, or does something more need to be done?
I don't know what it is.
Yeah, right. How do we answer that? We don't know what the problem is. I mean, that's it. That's the thing. Like, in Minnesota, I have a hard time moving past the Minnesota experience, because I remember, you know, you talk to people in the organization, it was clear he was pissed off at Kirk at times. And it was like, is this going to get resolved? You would hear, well, they've turned a corner, right? Like, Kirk came out, he made sure, like, I'm going to focus on him in the offense, you know, first quarter, gonna, you know, not necessarily force the ball to him, but I'm going to make sure that when he's getting himself open, I am delivering, and they've turned this corner. And then what happened? Like, it came apart. It was never going to end. So I'm like, is this like a Diggs issue? Because that's why I was like, there's no way this can be Josh Allen. And I'm a C-Mac here. Like, if he comes out and this is just a problem with Josh Allen, you ain't winning that, man. Like, you can't. I'm sorry. Like, this ain't Kirk Cousins. All right. You're not going to have people on your side this time. And by the way, you've been pretty prolific with Josh Allen. What's the problem? So I don't think it's that. I do. My assumption is that if it's not money, which I wouldn't think it's money, because his contract is pretty high up on the wide receiver shelf.
Top five, top four in every category. Yeah,
and if it's not Josh Allen, okay, so it's not quarterback and it's not money, that's typically, you know, right? Like, scheme, you know, how am I going to be? Yeah, usage. I have some kind of issue with the OC. You know, it's usually some underlying kind of problem with, you know, him and a coach and maybe how he's being coached. Maybe, you know, maybe Sean McDermott issue. I don't know. Maybe he's got an issue with someone in the front office. And it need to be smoothed out. But I do think we're going to figure out what this is eventually, right? We have, like you said, 5 weeks. Either we find it out in the 5 weeks or we find it out, you know, in training camp, or we find it out when they hit a wall at some point and whatever this was ultimately trickles out. But I got to admit, it's one of the weirder ones that I've seen in a while that got sort of semi-resolved or resolved, I guess, quickly. And we never really even knew what the issue was. So I do want to discuss, I don't want to take a ton of time on this. You know, Saquon brings up the issues with running back. We touched on that. Jory, you went to Giants camp. You tell me, you know, what's your feel coming out of Giants camp? Where are they at right now? I kind of watched, you know, the clip where he's talking about the valuing of the running back position and seemed, I guess, for Saquon, upset. Clearly some agitation there. Like, what's the underlying, I guess, direction there with Saquon, and what do you think coming out of their camp?
I think this is going to get done. I think what's difficult is when you think about the leverage that Lamar Jackson had wanting a fully guaranteed contract relative to Deshaun Watson, it reminds me a little bit about Saquon's leverage relative to Zeke. Zeke held out for 40 days of training camp until 4 days before the season opener. Saquon can't do that because he's on the tag and he has to have this deal by July 17th or it doesn't happen. I think that Saquon also knows that from the time they first made that deal back in October, November on the bye week, the market has been depressed. Now, I agree with him. It's probably not as depressed as the Miles Sanders deal indicates, but I do think it's been depressed. And I also think if you're Saquon, you have this injury history and you can't get past that. And so in some ways, the franchise tag is perfect for a player like him who's coming off a great year, who's shown really high potential, but who hasn't shown consistency. And so now he can get his money. What I'd be curious is, what would y'all think of a deal that's essentially, and I don't know that either side would want this, but that's typically the deal that ends up is not what either side wants. Essentially is like 2 years guaranteed of what the franchise tag equivalence would be like, or like the 1.5, 1.25, whatever. And you're like not committing to him for the long term. You're not committing that he's the direction that Brian Daboll's offense is going to go, because they have invested not necessarily high floor, but at least high ceiling prospects with some of like the Darren Waller type acquisitions to help the passing game, to bolster their offensive line a little bit. So I do think they want to be less dependent on Saquon Barkley than we've seen in the past. But what would you think about just sort of like giving him the equivalent of two franchise tags now that say like, hey, if you get hurt this year, you've still got a little bit money. We're not giving you money on the line for 4 years.
Giving him two franchise tags or splitting one franchise tag over 2 years?
I would say two franchise tags. Is that crazy?
What's
like the
total?
Equivalent of two like franchise tags?
So what's one franchise tag 20? Plus the 20%?
So it's called $22 million.
Yeah, $22 million for 2 years.
Oh my god, the franchise! Oh, I keep forgetting how terrible the franchise.
It's so low. Oh god. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I. To me, that's doable.
But think about what other guys got. Because they can't give him less than the tags.
No, you're right.
And you don't want to give him a long deal with his injury history, because you need more proof of that if you're the Giants. And so I think if you give him that, but you guarantee it to him now versus waiting a year, like I feel like that's a middle ground.
I like that solution, actually.
Yeah, I do too.
Because the thing is, you know, all that is true. And then another piece that's also true, they need him. Like they really need him out there on the football field. The game that comes back to mind last year is the Jaguars game, where at the end of it, he got the ball like 9 or 10 straight times and he closed it out and ended up winning the game for them in the fourth quarter. And, you know, I think he's one of those guys, like when he's healthy, like he's still a rare enough athlete and a rare enough talent that it ends up being a positive, even, you know, if you want to look at the running back data or whatever. Like, just to me, he's one of those guys that kind of transcends that a little bit. But when you look at like the Giants roster and how they're made up, It's a bunch of, you know, you got Darren Waller, who's a wild card. If he's on his game, then he's a top five tight end in the league.
I'm excited for him.
But outside of him, like at receiver, it's a bunch of wide receiver two, wide receiver three type of guys. And I think, you know, you still need a top dog in your offense. And right now, to me, that's still Saquon Barkley. Even, you know, if they're able to somewhat replicate the production, I still think, you know, just having Saquon Barkley, the player out there, matters a whole lot for this Giants team. So, you know, little 2 years, like you said, C-Rob, it's crazy. The franchise tag is about $10 million for the running backs, which is insane. But to me, like, if you tell me Saquon Barkley 2 for 22 and we'll guarantee most of it, I would offer that deal like today. He already said he's not trying to reset the market, so maybe that's something he would look at. And the fact that he said that he put his name on not resetting the market kind of makes me wonder what offers the Giants are throwing at him right now.
But I also have, I think the market is also factoring in Christian McCaffrey, who I believe is a receiver running back as much as anyone. And so I think not resetting the market isn't among like guys who are like, and I know Saquon is versatile too, but he's not Christian McCaffrey like ceiling that he's proven. And so I think that's kind of what we're talking about when we're not resetting the market.
If I'm the Giants though, I try to tack on, okay, so we go 10 to 12. Let's say to, 15. The third year, $15 million, completely unguaranteed. Because, so you get your two tags fully guaranteed. You're going to be here for at least the next 2 years. We're giving ourselves the third option, the $15 million, and just basically kind of seeing where this goes. If you stay healthy 2 straight years, you're a central piece of the offense. If all of a sudden we're staring, a potential deep playoff run in the face in 2025, now we have the option to pay you the $15 million, which is going to feel a little more painless because the cap will have moved, and if he's a central piece, you're going to be happy paying him that and then figuring out where to go from there. So I wouldn't do it. If I'm the Giants, I don't want to just do it for 2 years. I want to give myself a little bit of, I'm fine fully guaranteeing the two tags, but I want to make sure that on the back end, I at least have an extra year of control out of it. Which could still be enticing to him.
Help
because, yeah. And I mean, it, and to him, it should still be enticing because, as you said, if you're going to guarantee the money, just give it all to him in a signing bonus. So $22 million signing bonus, spread it out over 3 years, adjust, the salary cap the way you need to, early on, sign. If you got other players you want to extend them now. There's a lot of different ways to finesse it, but, I definitely wouldn't just do it for 2 years. Give yourself an extra. If you're going to give them the $22 million, you're going to guarantee it. I would say try to get a third year of control because who knows where they're going to be in 2015. I mean, if he blows it out the next 2 seasons and he stays healthy and all of a sudden you're like, man, he's a juggernaut. And now we're staring at him hitting free agency. Now we got to make a decision.
Fair.
Then you're really going to put yourself in a situation. Now he could decide, well, I'm going to sit out anyway. I mean, he could still make that decision, but at least give yourself some element of control.
Do you think he would sit out?
No.
I don't think so because...
I don't think anyone wants that. Like,
Why would you do that?
I think it's going to get done. Like, I get that they're not in the same place, but I feel like these two sides want to get it done. Like, what their starting point is on their goals is closer than we often see in these negotiations, in my opinion. And that, to me, gives me confidence that it will get done.
If that's the price, I don't know, man. That to me just doesn't seem like a lot if you get a 30-year control out of it.
As long as you
get that 30-year.
Something that's funny to me is, so we talked to the assistant general manager, Brandon Brown, this week, and he was talking about, like, look, we don't control the market, but we have to react to it and forecast it. And so precedent sets the market and the whole, like, he wasn't specifically saying it about Saquon, but you knew that he meant it about Saquon in the running back market. And then I had people in my mentions being like, was Daniel Jones worth that much for the market? So that was, I was definitely amused by that.
But isn't the answer yes? I mean, the quarterback market is messed up. Like, they're not even comparable. The running back market's sinking. It's getting more like it's completely getting battered. And meanwhile, the quarterback market's doing the opposite. Like it's zooming. And, now granted, some of the deals aren't fugazis out there after year one, but still it feels like everybody quarterback wise is getting paid a ton of money. I don't know, man. It's a wild situation to be talking about the Giants. A lot's happened in a year. The Giants have become a central talking point for us. All right, let's throw it to our advertisers. We'll come back on the other side and finish this up. Okay, welcome back in. Wanted to get to this story. Ran today, been working on this for a while. you know, I don't want to get into every layer of this. We'd be here for a week talking on this one. It's a story. It's a horizon story for the NFL. We're going to be looking at this probably for the next 10 years, if not beyond. But after the LIV PGA merger, I started working on a piece where I called around the NFL to a lot of C-suite executives, team presidents, other individuals that are high up in the executive chain that are typically sort of the lieutenants of owners that are sitting in on a lot of meetings where they're talking about how teams are purchased, what potential purchasing changes get changed down the road. The Commander sale is a good example. How, Jory, you wrote a great piece about how the NFL model selling teams may be changing here, where instead of it being just this one central owner with a ton of liquidity, billions and billions of billions of dollars to snap their fingers and write a check, could be larger groups where, you know, the central forward owner is someone who carries a lot of debt. That would open up the pool to a lot of different buyers. But when you look at what happened with PGA and LIV, the reason why this, I think, is important for the NFL, and something I want to talk to you guys about, is you have LIV, a golf tour created by the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund. They wanted to get involved in PGA's business. They wanted to get involved in golf. So they created a competing league. They started to take players away. It pushed the PGA to the table. And a merger occurred where basically, to me, I feel like very much so LIV is going to end up being in the driver's seat here in this merger. I think what was interesting for the NFL is the first time they looked out on American soil, North American soil, you know, in a major sports league, and saw a sovereign wealth fund, this being the Saudis, coming in and basically buying a controlling interest in a really significant sports platform in America. Now, Saudis have been doing this with their sovereign wealth fund around the globe. They're in the Premier League, Formula One, WWE. They've bought into massive ticket reselling platform. So they're really running around and creating this presence in sports and entertainment around the world. I think it becomes interesting for the NFL because the NFL doesn't allow foreign investment. And they especially don't allow sovereign wealth funds to come in and basically fund a minority or majority stake of an NFL team. I just want to know, you know, from the standpoint of you two looking at the league, seeing sales go through in the past, knowing that the Washington franchise just went for $6 billion, knowing that you now have this wealth fund, if it decides, hey, we want to get into the NFL, not necessarily because it overlaps with our culture and we can bring NFL, you know, teams here the way we can with golfers or soccer players. But we want to have a foothold in, as what one executive put it, Americana. Like this represents the biggest show in America. We want to have more political influence. There's this idea of sports washing. We want to burnish our image around the globe. So we're going to try to get into the NFL. I'm curious what you two think about the idea of NFL owners sitting there and going, we're going to keep the rules the way they are. And even if the Saudis at some point down the line come forward with an offer that's 50% better than what the best offer is on the table, 100% better than what the offer is on the table, would it motivate owners to start to rethink whether or not they want to allow sovereign wealth funds into the NFL? And in particular, because this is the prism that we focus through, the Saudis to come in and buy a piece of the NFL's league, whether it's a minority stake in a team, one of the 32 teams, just some aspect like that.
The way that I think of golf culture, right, is I'm trying to figure out like a polite way to put this. Like I normally, you know, if I was talking to my friends, I might say, you know, uppity culture, you know, big time culture, corporate culture, where, you know, when you see some of these finance organizations get bought out by some shady stuff, or whatever, that's never really surprising to me. What was surprising about like LIV buying golf in general, or the PGA in general, was there had been so much standoff, right? About, you know, the guys taking principal stands on, you shouldn't do this, other guys grabbing the money, and all of a sudden it kind of just doesn't matter anymore. And I think that nihilistic type of track path, it doesn't really surprise me, I guess, when you think about like what type of people have access to golf, what type of people are playing golf, and kind of what their lives and childhood looks like leading up to that point. But when you look at football, it at least portrays itself to be more in touch with like your everyday American, right? Someone who might get fired up about, you know, patriotism, nationalism, things that make, you know,
Americans tick. That didn't happen, you know, recently in football.
But, you know, it's like we were talking about before the show, right? It's hard for me to believe that a league that prides itself on pro-military stuff, we're doing flyovers before the games, we got the salute to service, you can go buy your training camp jersey that's camo if you want during the summer, that they will get in bed with the Saudis, like, especially if they, if I know that they every, like, especially once you get to that level of money, you could always want more, but you don't need it. It's tough for me to believe like that culture clash between the NFL and what they portray themselves as to, you know, Americans, getting in bed with the Saudis, it doesn't really track to me. And, you know, I think that that almost makes their stand a little bit easier against, you know, sovereign wealth like that, because you know how unpopular a decision it would be with the core of your fan base to do something like that. And I think it would be unpopular in a way that actually matters. So that's kind of where I see it breaking up, like the culture wars and the culture difference between, you know, your clientele for a golf match and your clientele for who's rabid outside a football game, you know, grilling 10 hours before the game starts.
And so people understand this idea of the quote unquote unpopularity of teaming up with a Saudi wealth fund. Let's just, I mean, look, the PGA kind of rolled it out there, right? Not kind of. I mean, there was this talk about the 9/11 attacks and the terrorists having ties to Saudi Arabia, right? Saudi Arabian descent. Human rights violations, right? The history of human rights violations that's been pretty well documented. And it's given rise to people looking at the Saudi wealth fund as going around the globe and buying its way into sports platforms as a way to sort of soften its image, as a way of becoming more influential. Now, to be fair, from the standpoint of the Saudis, it's diversification. We have an oil-based economy here. We're moving toward this 2030 initiative that's been laid down by the ruling family. And ultimately, that is to start to stretch out and become more involved, both socially, politically, culturally, with a lot of, you know, countries around the world. And some people said, hey, it's sports washing. They're basically trying to burnish the reputation and bury, you know, some of past quote-unquote misdeeds or the perception of them historically by buying into leagues and then, you know, basically buying their way into the hearts of fans or even buying their way into soccer players or this golf tour or Formula One and bringing it back to Saudi Arabia as a way of sort of taking their own citizens' eye off the ball. You know, they're it's like, you know, the games in the Colosseum. Let's have 1,000 days of games. People will forget about the problems in Rome because they're so busy looking at what's going on in the Colosseum right now. So that's sort of a little bit of this element here. Jory, you wrote the piece about, great piece, about how the Washington Commanders sale is a little different. This idea that, you know, the NFL is starting to trend, or at least potentially going to trend in the future, toward more of a group mentality when people come in to buy a team. And interestingly to me, part of this story, you know, executives are talking about, well, you know, that actually expands the pool. Now, if we can sell to groups, it expands the pool and we have less worry about team value spiking to 6 billion, 8 billion, 10 billion, whatever they may be. If we have groups we can bring to the table, we don't have to worry about changing our rules and deciding, hey, you know what? We haven't historically done it, but we're gonna change the regs and we're gonna allow for foreign investment, and that may be the door that cracks it open to, you know, a sovereign wealth fund like Saudi Arabia stepping in and ultimately owning a team the way that they do in the Premier League.
Right, there are two elements here, which is the cultural implication and the financial implication. I think culturally, at first, you think the NFL is not the most moralistic or perceived as moralistic sports league in this country. So why would they be taking a harder stand than the NBA, than the PGA Tour, all of that? But it's almost the same way that they might not be viewed as more progressive. Like, this is actually not necessarily a progressive issue. And I think that a group that is going to be so upset about Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the national anthem is then going to allow Saudis into this league, you start to wonder about that. When you get into the financial implications, I think you could say they don't need the money. They already have so much popularity, so much money. Do they really need that? Whereas other sports leagues might be more desperate for that kind of attention and money. But that's actually where I run into skepticism that this could potentially happen, because money seems to talk. And if you're telling me the Saudis are offering twice as much money to a franchise, even the owners are going to think twice about that. And the same way that they were super against gambling and super against this, and now they're trying to put this whole PR campaign out there of why their gambling rules make sense when I'm not sure they do, while still having a team in Vegas, a Super Bowl in Vegas, a Pro Bowl in Vegas, all of these things. It's like, I feel like you see how blatantly inconsistent their values can be with the integrity of the game already, that why would that not eventually extend to the Saudis, especially when they can make a lot more money off the Saudis than they could off of gambling, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. And it was, you get to this point, these conversations with executives, and they go, you know, they want to say never, you know, but they're like, you can never say never in this league, because,
yeah,
you know, the money, if the money gets to a certain point. Now, the Broncos sales, the Broncos and the Washington sale astronomically pushed franchise values forward. But I'm paraphrasing here, but one executive brought up the idea of, like, what if at that point, knowing, hey, there's no foreign investment, what if the Saudi Wealth Fund had come in and said, you know what, Bolin family, we're going to give you double your offer. We're going to give you $10 billion for your team. Or Dan Snyder, you got $6 billion on the table. We're going to give you $9 billion, or we're going to give you $12 billion. What are you going to do? You know, and this executive made the point, like, that might have caused, like, some kicking and screaming. Maybe the Bolin family, no, but, like, Dan Snyder probably would have said, wait a minute, I'm looking at $6 billion versus $12 billion. I'm going to fight.
So, Sirup, since you're the one who's been having all these conversations with executives and you're so plugged in, I would ask you, if the NFL doesn't have some sort of public statement on it, do you think they will have a private deal among owners or private understanding of what it would take to cross this threshold, how they're dealing with it, and what would that look like, and how soon would they get that into practice?
I think it's a really good question. Like, at that, to me, the event that happened between the PGA and LIV, it seems to be this consensus of, like, is the NFL worried about that? Like, you know, oh, what if the Saudis create, like, a competing league and try to force their way into the NFL or whatever? There didn't seem to be a lot of, like, worry about that. But it was the, maybe we should have a conversation, though, now, you know, about what could potentially happen in the future. What could happen when the Seattle Seahawks are sold? What could happen when, you know, some unforeseen, you know, franchise that we're looking at right now gets sold down the line? Let's not wait to have that conversation. And let's run through all the scenarios. And those scenarios are things like, as we just talked about, what if the Saudi Wealth Fund steps in and says, we know your rules and regs are like this. We know we can't get in, but we're going to go ahead and we're going to set a $15 billion check on the table. 32 teams, any of you interested in that? And if you're interested in that, call us and let's start talking about how we can change the regs to allow us to be able to buy a team, because that check's going to sit there. And maybe in 10 years, that check will be $20 billion until we can figure out a way to ultimately resolve this. So you have that conversation. How do you ward off owners who would look at that and go, yeah, you know, morally or politically, it might be problematic, but that's a lot of money. That'll set up our kids, kids, kids. You know, we're talking about, you know, not generational wealth. We're talking about generations upon generations that are going to now be walking away with wealth. We got to have that conversation. So you have that conversation now. And as you said, maybe it's an off the books talk. How do we ward this off in the future? How do we build certain voting blocks to make sure no matter what, we'll always be able to win this argument? And then I think you go into the conversation about force. What if a LIV situation happens? What if the Saudis say, let's wait. Okay, they won't let us in. We want in just because we want a piece of Americana and we can afford it. let's wait, and USFL is going to fail eventually. The XFL is going to fail eventually. It's happened over and over again. They already have team structures set up. They have certain contracts in place. We're going to buy the league. So when they fold, we're going to buy the league, and then we're going to set about buying drafts. Next draft that comes up, go get Caleb Williams. Figure out what it costs. We're going to buy him. We're going to bring him into our league. Drake May, we're going to buy him. We're going to bring him early. Marvin Harrison Jr., we're going to buy him. We're going to bring him early. We're especially going to hit him hard on quarterbacks. And we're going to ultimately try to force them to come to the table USFL style in the 80s, even though it's a completely different ballgame now for the NFL. That's another conversation you have now. What if, you know, you play out the scenarios? And I said this to you before we kind of rolled, is sort of like when the government games out theoretical scenarios that could happen. Maybe they're super unlikely, but you bring in experts and professors and economists and all these individuals to game out scenarios, the wild scenarios that may never happen, just so that you have that booklet in the drawer in case it ever happens. The aliens are never going to land on the coast of Florida. But if they do, we got this book that we can pull out that says, hey, in the unlikeliest scenario this ever happens, here's what you should expect economically, politically, globally, from your citizens, all these different scenarios. I think the NFL has to, you know, consider walking through that. And I actually think that there's momentum. I think there's agreement on the C-suite level, like, probably just have a conversation about this, you know, just to consider what could be coming in the future, because sports is changing, and the Saudis aren't the only sovereign wealth fund on earth. I think it's they're the seventh largest, I believe, sovereign wealth fund, and they have $650 billion under management. It's going to be over $1 trillion, I think, by 2025. You should talk about that, because, you know, if they're really intent on getting a larger platform in America beyond the PGA Tour, where do you go? You go straight to the top, and that's the NFL.
So, Zurab, let's break it down really simply. Why should NFL fans care about this? And why should NFL fans who maybe don't follow golf and who maybe haven't been following the PGA and LIV merger quite as much care about what this means?
I mean, I think there's a couple of different avenues. Number one, what do you like? How do you feel about it personally, like politically? As C-Max said, it hits a little different because the NFL plays so hard and fast to patriotism, the flyovers, all these different things. And there's no question that when you look at the background, the Saudis' history, there are some things that have been alleged and, you know, on some level, at least thought in the U.S. government to have been proven that have occurred, you know, potential murder of a Washington Post columnist, in a foreign embassy, you know, human rights violations, the fact that 9/11 families clearly are not okay with any sort of investment or you know, corporations that would allow the Saudi wealth fund in and, you know, getting a foothold into America because of, as we said, the country of origin of some of the 9/11 terrorists. It's something that I think, you know, from an NFL fan standpoint, if you cared about the flag stuff, you're going to care about this, right? I don't think there's any question about that. And as one executive said, he was like, this would create like a story in every, you know, all 32 franchises. You're going to have people asking the Maras and you know, the Tishes, you're going to vote for this? You're going to vote to pass this and allow this to occur? Jerry Jones. You're gonna, you know, Robert Kraft. Like it becomes a pressure point for every NFL owner, beyond just sort of the optics of it and the political nature of it. You know, I think you would ask yourself, there's certain elements of if the Saudi wealth fund were to come in and buy a team, you would think, okay, extreme amount of resources, building massive infrastructure, stadium would be state of the art, coaching staff would be, you know, you would think theoretically chalked up with the best technologically, all these other things, the travel. But the one thing that you would not be able to get because of how the NFL works is there's a salary cap. And the salary cap and free agency and the draft all work to force teams toward the middle. works to force everybody to kind of not have the disparity that you do have in, say, the Premier League, like in soccer, where you don't have a cap and you can go and blow it out and go and bring in the, you know, 4, 5, 6 best players you can get your hands on and pay extreme amounts of money and absolutely dwarf other franchises. You're not going to have that ability if you're a fan base and you're saying, oh, yeah, we're okay with a wealth fund owning our team because we'll be able to have all the best players. That's not going to work because the NFL has a cap. In a really, 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 really unlikely sort of niche here, if you're an NFL fan, you would ask yourself, well, if they opened up teams to being purchased by sovereign wealth funds, what if you get enough in where they change the rules and regs of the NFL and say, get rid of the cap? We're no longer going to have a salary cap in the NFL. We're going to do it like the Premier League does. Because, okay,
that would be interesting.
Yeah, we changed the rules, and by 2045, we now have, you know, a dozen teams owned by either foreign, you know, foreign money or foreign wealth funds, and they decide, yeah, the way you guys do this with the cap sucks. Let's get rid of the cap. So they build a voting block, and they strike down the salary cap in the next CBA. You know, the next negotiation, there's no longer a cap, and maybe they change the way that the NFL does business. Like I said, extremely unlikely, but definitely one of those what if conversations that I think you have if you're the NFL. It's food for thought. Read the piece. It's complicated. It's long. Like I said, we only really touched on certain elements of it. It's the kind of thing where you could probably do a series of podcasts about it. And I do think, though, this is going to be a long-term issue for the NFL. I would encourage people to check out the piece. It's an interesting thing to think about at the very least. So, all right, let's close it out. We will be back next Thursday. You can find myself on Twitter at Charles Robinson. You can get Jory Epstein at Jory Epstein. You can see Mac at Vorverts. And you can get our ace producer, Stone Rochelle, SJ Rochelle. And as always, help us keep Therese Paylor's legacy alive. Check out BreakingT.com. That's capital T / Therese for the all juice tier hoodie. Remember that proceeds from that purchase go to support the Therese A. Paylor scholarships at Howard University, as well as Missouri. And if you could, please check out our new NBA podcast, Ball Don't Lie, featuring Vinny Goodwill, Jake Fisher, Dan Devine, and Kristen Peek, as well as our new MLB podcast, Bandwagon, featuring Hannah Kaiser and Zach Kreiser, both available wherever you get your podcasts. Please, if you could, leave a 5-star review, tell a friend, help us grow the pod, and we will see you next Thursday. Peace.